Welcome to the Wealth Matters Podcast, where investors come together to better understand how to build passive cash flow and create generational wealth without all the confusing mumbo-jumbo. Here's your host and co-author of Amazon number one bestseller, Alpesh Pamar.
Welcome to Wealth Matters Podcast. I am going to talk to someone. I think he's pretty savvy in real estate world, and he has his own podcast. He has his own business. He's the CEO of Next Level Income, and here is the book he has authored, and he was gracious enough to send this book to me. So thank you so much for that. So welcome, Chris Larson.
Thank you, Alpesh. It's awesome to be here all the way on the other side of the country. And look, you got a copy of the book. And if you're listening today, you can go to our website and you can get a free copy too. I'll send you one, nextlevelincome.com. Just click on the book link.
Thank you so much, Chris, for doing that. So Chris, let's get started without wasting our time, because I know I'm late by 5-10 minutes and I don't want to waste any of your more time. So tell us something interesting or funny about yourself.
Oh boy, I got a lot of funny things. So when I was an engineer in college, I'd end up in these like study groups, and I'd be like, "What, guys?" I'm like, "Why am I here?" And they'd say, "You're here for the comic relief, Chris." So I tell people that I wasn't an engineer because my counselor in college pulled me aside, my advisor, and said, "Hey, Chris," he goes, "you're not smart enough to be an engineer, and you have too much personality. So you need to go to find something else to do." So I spent 18 years in the medical device industry. And that was the bulk of my career. But a lot of people say, "When did you start investing in real estate?" Assuming that I started it after I was in the medical device industry. But I became an investor at 21, in my first real estate property. And I just needed money to become an investor. And that's why I went into that career path.
Oh, that's awesome. So that's funny. I'm an engineer. And
I know.
And the funny thing is also I was there for comic relief as well.
There we go. Here we are, lowly investors now. So it worked out okay.
Yeah. So how did you get started with real estate then? You said when you were 21? What happened?
Yeah. So look, you know, you understand I'm a numbers guy.
Yep.
And I raced my bike for a lot of years, and I love bicycling and cycling because it's a numbers game. It's all a function of power and weight.
Yes.
And how you can increase your power. And, you know, there's all this technology that's involved. It's amazing, amazing technology, which I love. And that is what I like about engineering. I love the concepts. I love the numbers. I don't love sitting behind a computer though, but that's what I was doing in college. I was sitting behind a computer. I was watching the stock market. I taught myself how to day trade, how to swing trade, how to follow trends and technical analysis. And I was a junior in college making like $5,000 a month day trading, which is great at the time. Oh,
you mentioned about bikes. So I just wanted to show you my bike. Right, yeah. Cause I just got a high-end bike too.
I love it. Well, you got to come back to Asheville and I will take you for some rides up in the mountains. And
I didn't want to distract you, but that was funny.
Oh, it's all good.
You mentioned biking.
I love it, man. Well, we can talk about that. Listen, I think it really relates to our conversation today because, you know, whether you look at the stock market, whether you look at real estate, whether you look at cycling, whether you look at engineering, it's engineers understand that to solve a problem, you come up with the assumptions, then you come up with the solution through the problem solving or the algorithm that you provide. And what I did not like about the stock market was that the assumptions changed. Like, and you didn't know, you know, what the variables were and what the constants were.
Right.
I became intrigued and enamored with real estate because I could have more control, and that gave me more comfort. So, you know, some people would say, "Hey, you know, you like to take risks. You like to do fun things." I rafted down the Grand Canyon. That's a picture of one of my favorite sections of the river for almost 3 weeks. People are like, "But I take controlled risks when I know there's a high probability of a positive outcome." And that's what I liked about real estate. So I bought my first property at 21 after becoming disenchanted with trading after a couple of years. And we've refined our process over the last more than two decades, Alpesh. And, you know, I'd love to talk about that today, kind of looking at the real estate cycles and how we can use historical information and historical analysis and use that to help us predict some of the future trends in the market.
Oh, that's very interesting. And this is exactly what I went through the path as well. So it was funny just that I started very late, but I did the options trading, futures trading, and then realize this is not my cup of tea because I'm not able to control a lot of things, right? There are robo traders, there are hedge funds. So no, that's pretty, that is very interesting. So you started at 21, what did you buy? And what kind of analysis you went through at that time, right?
So first off, I'll start with what I purchased. I'll talk about how I kind of decided on the areas. So first off, I didn't have a lot of money. You know, I was making money in the stock market, but I still didn't have tons of money, right? My first property, $90,000 townhouse in Blacksburg, Virginia, paid $3,000 down to get that townhouse. My mom co-signed on a loan. Nice. So that was the first one. Then I talked to my neighbor. He was moving out. I negotiated with him, bought that property from him.
Oh, wow.
As well. Yep. And then bought another townhouse and then bought a condo and then bought another condo and then bought a house. So it was single family properties that we were purchasing and renting out. And real simple strategy. I just wanted to buy in nice areas and I wanted to pay down the mortgages. So I had, you know, nice cash flow of about 10 grand a month coming in afterwards. And, you know, so I did that for a while, but it just, you know, anybody that's listening, I know there's a lot of people listening that own single family homes. Like, I think the more you get, the more you think, how can I get out from underneath?
Right, exactly.
Aspects of these things, right? So after, you know, more than a decade of doing that, I realized, hey, the returns aren't what they should be, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's gotta be a better way to do this. And at this point, my wife and I had moved to Asheville, North Carolina. And again, being a good engineer, I had my Excel spreadsheet that I put together and I stacked rank all these cities in the country. And some people are like, I don't believe you. I dug out my spreadsheet from early 2000s and it had all these cities on there that were ranked. And, you know, I mean, shoot, you could, if you went through the top 20 cities and bought in any of those cities, you would have done fantastic. But Asheville was number 3 on the list.
Oh.
And we were living in DC at the time. We're starting out our career. We thought, hey,
wow, totally different, huh? From a big city.
Oh, totally different. But it's, you know, and I talk about this in one of my blog posts, you know, you can employ what's called geographic arbitrage if you're young. And what I mean is you move to areas based upon what you want to get. So if you want a job, you want to move to an area that's growing fast, that has lots of opportunities in the industry that you want. But then once you're making money, why not move to an area with a better quality of life that's also growing quicker, but has a lower cost of living? And then what you can do is what a lot of people are doing that are moving from like the Northeast, you can sell, you can cash out, you can get more for your money. And then when maybe your career's more established, when you don't have to have the diversity of options in your career, maybe you're more focused on growing a family as we were, or maybe riding my bike a little bit too, then you can move to a nicer area and still do well.
Right.
So, you know, so all the things that, you know, I talk about doing then, we do the same thing now. So demographic research, analyzing trends, where people are moving, job growth, population growth, income growth, all of these things are very important when it comes to finding the next best areas in the world or in the country to invest.
Oh, that's awesome. And, you know, you mentioned Northeast, same thing with happening with California as well, right? A lot of people are moving out, but still the housing market is still very hot. So that's why I want to talk about, you know, the real estate cycles, right? So can you tell us where we are in the real estate cycle and what you see if you have the crystal ball?
Yes, I have a crystal ball, but what I've noticed over time is it's kind of cloudy now, Peck.
Yes.
So, you know, I may not be right on, but here's the thing. I like to bet on big trends, right? Like, you know, tidal shifts, if you will. So I'm not going to say that I can predict things with perfect certainty. And like, I'm not going to tell you when to buy and sell in the stock market and do those sorts of things. Although there's a lot of data out there that, you know, you can learn to trade in the stock market. I want to bet on big trends that we can see coming years and sometimes decades in advance. Okay. And I'll give you everything that I talked about today. I'll give listeners something that they can go on my website and they can see me talk about it more in depth. So if you want to move somewhere or you're younger in your career and you're trying to figure it out, check out my blog post, Where Are People Moving? And that's the 2022 edition that was published in February. You can check that out. But let's talk about like where are we in the cycle. So before we talk about that, we need to understand how long are real estate cycles? How long are economic cycles? And we hear different things. We hear 7-year cycles, so like 7-year cycles, 9-year cycles. If you blend them all together, you're getting macro cycles on the order of, you know, 18 to 20 years. Now, if you want to look at real estate specifically in this country, going back to when we started tracking it in the 1800s, the average cycle length in real estate is 18.6 years.
Oh, really? Not 10 years. Oh, okay.
Not 10 years. But that's the thing. If you say, hey, 9 or 10 years, you add two together and you're going to get these 20-year cycles.
Okay.
The 7-year cycles that people talk about, if you stack 2 7-year cycles together with a 4-year downturn like we saw coming out of 2008, which is historically what we see, that's 18 years as well. So all
that
these
makes sense, right? 2001 through 2007 or 8, and then till 2012, we were pretty much in downturn. And then since 2012, we have been on a tear.
Exactly. So, and Phil Anderson has a great book called The Secret Life of Real Estate and Banking. And just like when I go to the hotel and I open up my nightstand, there's a Bible in there. When I open up my desk drawer, this is my real estate.
Oh, really? Bible. Okay. I have not read that. And that's, I got to read it.
It's fantastic. And what he does, he goes back and he documents all the data. So that's what you can, and whatever I talk about today, you can actually look back and say, hey, is Chris crazy or is he actually basing this on something? So let's say you have that 18-year cycle. So the question is, when do you start that? So the start of the cycle is going to come from the bottom of the last cycle. So 2012, like you mentioned.
Okay.
Then you have 2 7-year portions of the cycle after that. The first 7-year portion is the first trend. And that's in general quite linear. And what you're going to see, you know, land prices are going to start to come back. We started buying land. We started building spec homes. And here's what you look out for at that time. Banks were not lending before that, right?
Yeah.
You know, banks had called lines of credit. That's when you start to see banks begin to lend again. My wife called over 30 banks.
Oh, wow.
And the last one she called, which was literally the last one on her list, said, we just started to lend on spec homes again. That is a good sign that you're at the bottom of the cycle and you're starting to come back when banks start to determine that. Because these people, you know, they're the ones taking risks. This is smart money talking, right? The cycle then is going to increase pretty linearly coming in there. And there's also a stock market component, which overlays this.
Yes.
But the thing is, all these cycles are based on land expansion of credit. So land, if you think about land, you put money down and then you borrow on land, credit expands, you know, most people own property and these cycles are levered off of a lot of this credit. So when you come out of that cycle, it's largely linear and people, again, we think linearly. So, you know, we look back and we say, okay, this makes sense. And usually after about 7 years, and you can go back and at the end of 2019, I was on some podcasts and you can go back and listen to them. I said, hey, we're coming into the point where we need to be aware of a mid-cycle slowdown, which typically comes after that first 7 years.
And that's what we thought in 2019. Yeah. That's what I told my wife. Mm-hmm. I was telling everyone that now it's time. And COVID happens and
COVID
government just switched everything by starting to print money or handing out free money. It's just...
Yeah. And look, we can go back. You know what happened last time in the same point in the cycle? It was 9/11. Everybody remembers 9/11. Everybody remembers the stock market
crash.
But
I do remember the crash, yes.
Yeah. And then real estate pulled back. The government pumped money and stimulus. And then obviously the war had a different effect, but that supercharged you know, the economy. Again, for better or worse, this isn't political. This is just the way it happens. And go back to the savings and loan crisis before that. Go back to the inflationary crisis in the 1980s, which is, I would equate the 1980s coming into the early 1990s and the savings and loan crisis to where we are today, even though that's two cycles ago, in my opinion.
Yep, yep.
So
that was right after Gulf War, right? 1989 and then
There you go. Exactly. So yeah. So think about that kind of where we are in the world today. And you say, okay, we just went through this period. You know, now people are like, wow, look how resilient real estate is. The stock market is quite volatile. People are saying, well, hey, Chris, maybe the crash is already here. I don't think so. I think that we're going to come out of where we are today. I think that, interest rates are going to moderate. I think the stock market is going to kind of level off here at some point, in my opinion. And here's why. We have $6 trillion of liquidity floating around looking for yield in the market today. We have the world's biggest generation in history, the millennials. Now, the baby boomers were a more concentrated generation, but their children, the millennials, are actually a bigger generation. They have had to delay formation of households for a lot of years. Housing prices are high. However, if you look at the affordability, so the amount of disposable income that the population has today versus what it costs to buy a home, it's still affordable. So people say, oh, Chris, it's not affordable to buy a house right now because home prices are high, but disposable income is higher and interest rates are lower than we've seen historically. And you have to measure all that together. So that's gonna keep some buoyancy under the market in my perspective. And the other problem we have is there is a lack of stock, of housing stock.
So, yes, that's the biggest problem, supply and demand.
Yeah, so that's one of the reasons I love multifamily as you do, Alpesh, because you know, if you can't buy a home, you're gonna have to rent longer.
You need a roof.
We also like self-storage because if you can't buy a home, then, and that's why we have multifamily offerings, we have self-storage offerings, mobile home parks. Exactly. Yeah. So these are all fantastic. So I think that right now we probably have about 3 more years left in this cycle. And then we get into the most dangerous part of the cycle, which is kind of like the winner's curse. And that's where people think, well, wow, we went through all these years, we came out of through the Great Recession, we went through COVID, you know, there was this war, interest rates, and real estate just doesn't go down. And that's right. When you know we're getting towards the end of the last part of this cycle, in my opinion.
So you still think that it's not 2022 or 2023? It may be 2025 or beyond.
Yeah. So I think that, we're probably looking at about 3, maybe 4 years from now. So 2025, maybe early 2026, in my opinion of, you know, if we look historically at that. And again, I'm not saying, hey, bet everything, dump everything, you know, do your own research. But then the question is like, what do you do? Like, what do you do during this period?
Right. And that's a good point. Also, again, I may be wrong as well, because none of us can see the, you know, future.
Right.
But real estate is also dependent on the market, right? And which right. we saw, right? Especially I was underwater. I had a townhouse here in San Francisco Bay Area. Right. I was underwater. And for us, it bottomed out in 2009 or 10. Because that was the worst period, especially the coastal market, like and the Floridas and Phoenix. Whereas I saw that other markets, Northeast, they just started going down in 2011 and 2012, especially I was watching New Jersey, New York, and even Chicago market, et cetera. So it's also market dependent, right? Because some markets will be able to stay afloat because of just the net migration as well as job growth, right? Dallas and Austin, they didn't correct like crazy during that whole, you know, bust, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so you do have, so again, and that's a question of like, when you're working with an operator, like if you say, Chris, why did you guys just buy a property in Nashville, Tennessee? You're gonna wanna look at the specifics and the specific economics of a market, right? So what the trends we're talking about are kind of like overall countrywide trends and even worldwide trends now that we're seeing, because you know the real estate markets, people are mobile, they're also internationally mobile, interest rates are correlated around the world, so you know we have a lot of international capital flowing into the United States. So yeah, you can't just say, oh, this is a blanket statement, every market's the same. No, that's not it at all. You have to be conscious of, you know, different markets. You want to invest in the best markets around the country during this time, and that's regardless of what part of the cycle you're in, obviously.
So let me throw you a curveball. Now that you mentioned best markets, what are the best markets right now?
Yeah. So, I mean, I would say just look at where we've invested, but, and I wrote a blog post about this here. And I love it. I talk about, where people are moving. And in that post that I mentioned earlier, you can look and you can say, hey, United Van Lines, like where are people moving in the country?
U-Haul, United Van Lines.
Yeah, exactly. And then you also layer in housing affordability in these things. So in my opinion, the greater Southeast, including Texas, Florida, the Carolinas, Georgia, these are all great markets. Arizona is a terrific market. And you say, well, that makes sense, Chris, because people are, like you said, leaving California. Where are they moving? It's easier to move to Arizona or Texas from California, or maybe Colorado or Idaho.
Idaho,
and I love Utah. Salt Lake's a great market, in my opinion. Who's moving to the Southeast? A lot of people from, you know, the Northeast
are moving
down
south.
Yep. Chicago, Midwest, exactly. And you do see people from California moving, but you know, those are kind of the big regions I like. And then we like secondary markets in those larger markets. So think cities like Raleigh and Charlotte, Greenville and Charleston, South Carolina, Savannah, Georgia, Orlando. We just bought a property in Fort Myers, Florida, just south of Naples. Yeah. Houston, Texas, and Nashville, Tennessee, which we just closed on this past week. It's one of the top markets in the country. Lots of young people moving there. It's a blast. Yep. And the thing is, it's still affordable to move there. So that's what you have to look at. You say, well, hey, this is a great market, but does it have room to still run, to raise rents, you know, and attract people for all these other reasons? And in my opinion, it really does.
Oh, that's awesome. Thank you for sharing that, Chris. So another question I have now that we spoke about these trends and the cycles and all, and you mentioned that next 3 years, some are saying next year or maybe 5 years. So what are some of the best places to put my money in for next 5 years?
Yeah. So first off, you say, where is the demand, right? So where's the demand right now? There's still a huge residential demand. So we're building some smaller residential developments, but we're keeping the timeline on the 2 year, 3 year timeline when we're doing those developments. Multifamily. So if you look at the trends, if people can't buy a home, what segments of multifamily are going to benefit the most? It's going to be the segments of multifamily that are the people that are buying homes. Okay.
Yes.
So that's probably class A multifamily,
class A,
in my opinion. Also, because you can't really build affordable housing, you know, some of those more affordable options like mobile homes.
Mobile home parks.
Yep. And they're also going to offer higher cash flow. So that's kind of from a overall demographics perspective. But then if you look at the way markets are structured and who's buying and selling these, I look at from a business perspective, okay, what markets still have fragmentation within them? So self-storage and multifamily are still largely owned by mom and pops.
Yes.
They're not sophisticated, right? So, I mean, you know what we're doing with one of our projects here in South Carolina, Alpesh, that we're partners on.
Yeah, mobile home park, same thing, owned by mom and pop. Yep.
That's right. And we can go in and we can optimize, you know, everything from the billing structure towards the operations, towards, you know, the value add component. You can do the same thing with self-storage. My favorite new area of investment. I just got back from Nashville, not just because we closed on a multifamily deal there, because they had the car wash show there. And our group started to acquire car washes this year. And the reason is it's highly fragmented. There's not even a major player in the market.
We are looking into it, man. We are talking the same language. So literally.
Yeah. There we go.
And one of my friends just bought one. So we are now discussing about buying more.
Yeah, I would. And so here's why I think they're great. And, you know, I'm a big fan and we can continue that discussion, but they're high cash flow. They're highly fragmented. So you have a lot of mom and pops that are not sophisticated. And this doesn't mean these aren't smart people. These aren't great business operators, but if I can come in, I can employ new technologies, just simple sales strategies to increase revenue. Maybe I can come in and put an app on your phone. So it's easier for you to pay and appeal towards, you know, the new, you know, mobile generation, you know, that's, you know, been using, that are native, you know, to the digital, you know, landscape for their entire life. These are things that increase revenues, right? But also when you exit, you have a lot of private equity groups that are interested if you can provide, just like mobile homes, a really nice package or portfolio of these types of businesses.
And then stable returns. Yeah,
exactly. Yep. So there's an opportunity, in my opinion, over the next 10 years for investors to come in. And if you look at all of these, what you'll notice is that I'm a fan of income producing value add assets, because in downturns, yes, cash is king, but cash flow is king. Yep. The people that got crushed in the last downturn were those that didn't have cash flow, were over leveraged. They didn't have cash sitting on the sidelines. So cash flow assets, lower reasonable leverage, and then start building over the next 3 years your cash. And we can talk about where I like to stash my cash so that you have the ability to take advantage of the opportunities the next time they come.
Oh, that's a great point. And I keep telling everyone, for me, the two things I look for in any investment is the cash flow and depreciation benefits, right? And that's why real estate was the best thing ever. And amazing. When we figured out we could do the same thing with Bitcoin mining, we applied the same principles that we were able to get the tax benefits and monthly cash flow, and you can't beat that. If I get monthly cash, I know I can replace my income, or I can even continue to reinvest that cash. So now you have money, you know, invested in more than one deal, right? So I totally agree. So where are you?
I'm a big fan of that as well.
Of course, we are speaking to the choir, man.
A little bit.
So where do you plan to keep stash your cash?
Yeah. So first off, it's kind of a misnomer because I don't like to have cash.
Nope.
Because cash, I mean, if you believe that CPI is 8.5%, then I got lots of stuff I can sell you. But look, I just want to put my hand on your shoulder.
It's like 15-16%.
It's insane, right? Yeah. So yeah, you don't, if you have cash just sitting in the bank, it's rotting, right? Yeah. So you want to have your money put somewhere that's inflation resistant. I do like Bitcoin. I know it's been beat up here recently, which I don't mind because I've been accumulating that.
Exactly.
But what we do, how we structure, and we actually have a specific strategy that we use. It's called the Investment Optimizer. Again, this is on my website. You can click the banking link. And we use, which some people know about this, some people, this may be your first time hearing it, but it's an arbitrage technique. So if I could tell you, you can borrow money at 3%, you can earn 5%, even if you don't invest it, how much money would you want?
Right. A lot.
I mean, you can, yeah, as much as like, right.
Exactly.
If you can invest at a higher rate than you can borrow. So we use specifically structured life insurance contracts to do this. Yep. I'm a licensed life insurance agent. I was licensed 20 years ago. I got relicensed during COVID. But that's what we do. We have life insurance contracts set up our family so that we can put money in there. So it's not just sitting in cash, but we have access to it whenever we want. And that helped us not only during COVID when we needed cash to help float our businesses, the construction of our new house, but also gives us the opportunity to go out and invest. And you can let that money work even if you're trying to build that capital sitting on the sidelines.
No, thank you for sharing that. And I love that strategy. I have been personally doing it since 2016 as well. So I know how it works.
Amazing. Amazing.
No, this is awesome. Thank you, Chris. Let's take a quick break. And after the break, we'll go through the same questions I ask every guest.
You're listening to the Wealth Matters Podcast.
The Wealth Matters Podcast.
For more info about what we do, check us out at wealthmatters.com. It's wealth, W-E-A-L-T-H, matters, M-A-T-R-S.com.
Welcome back to Wealth Matters Podcast. Chris Larson here shared lots of golden nuggets. I'll highly recommend you go back and re-listen to this episode or re-watch. And I'm going to go and buy, of course, the book he recommended, as well as I have his book, Next Level Income, which I'm going to read again. But Chris, are you ready for fire round?
Always ready. Let's do it.
Let's do it. Would you be changing any business or investment strategy after this pandemic is over? And I'm hoping it's over.
Yeah, I hope it is too. We shifted into higher quality assets right before the pandemic. And I think that is going to be a winner. You know, we talked about high cash flow assets, lower volatility here. And I think we're going to persist for the next 3 years.
Well, that's awesome. Thank you for sharing that. Favorite real estate or finance or any other related book? I think you already shared that.
Yeah, I'll reiterate because we can talk about a lot of different ones. But again, it was The Secret Life of Real Estate and Banking by Philip Anderson. If you're intrigued by some of the stuff that we talked about, there's a ton of information and data in there. And, you know, Phil talks about the numbers that helped me get to that 18.6 precise figure on average of how these real estate cycles go.
I must read that book. Any tool or website you recommend or you cannot live without?
I'll tell you what, this is a little different than the financial side of things, but you know, if you look at my goals, the number one topic or number one category of my goals is health. So I think, you know, look, if you could trade your time for something, what would it be? If you trade your money for something, what would it be?
Yes.
Yeah. And my thing is time. So if we can live longer, we can have a bigger impact. I mean, there's a lot of great resources out there. I talk about Lifespan, which is a book by David Sinclair. And if you go and you search for his supplement list, it can help you extend your life by 20%. So if you do nothing else from this podcast, check out David Sinclair's Lifespan.
That's awesome, man. You are sharing a lot of golden nuggets. I have to buy so many books. I have like 20 plus to read already.
I know. I'm in the same boat, man. I'm always adding to my list faster.
Yeah.
I can read through them.
Like so many now. Any advice for beginner investors?
Yeah, look. So first off, I mean, I spend more money on coaching than I made my first year as a professional out in the workforce. So if you're a beginner investor, you know, there's a point where you have to stop learning and start taking action. I say stop learning, just take a pause, keep learning, but find somebody whose success you can emulate and then learn from them. If you can't afford to work with them, ask what you can do for them to go work with them, but find a mentor, find somebody you can work. We have a coaching program that we have. And, you know, I mean, shoot, you can go to our website and get 90% of what we talk about for free. So do that first, but then find somebody that can hold you accountable. That's the big thing. Resources, plan, and accountability.
How do you give back?
Yeah. So if you haven't guessed, I'm big on financial literacy. And we have, we give back through our website. We also started a financial literacy program with a local nonprofit here in Asheville, North Carolina, called Open Doors of Asheville. And it's something that I think is, you know, sorely missing from, you know, the education that most people, not just children, but people get in this country.
I agree. How can my listeners reach out to you?
Yeah. So again, if you want a copy of the book, I'll send you one for free, nextlevelincome.com. You can check out blogs and podcasts talking in more detail about what we talked about today. Get a free copy of my book. Go to the banking link and learn about our investment optimizer approach that you can use to increase your returns 20% on your real estate investments. And if there's something specifically that we talked about today and you want to reach out directly to me, chris@nextlevelincome.com.
Thank you so much, Chris, for your time, man. I had a lot of fun.
Me too, Alpesh. It was awesome, and I look forward to getting together for a bike ride.
Yeah, we got to.
Thanks for listening to the Wealth Matters podcast. If you enjoyed it, please leave us a 5-star rating on iTunes so others can enjoy the show too. Have a great week, and happy investing!